I'm Betty Hoffman, and I am an alcoholic. And I have to get my glasses. My home group is also Grover's. It's one of the two best, I'm stealing from Vic, one of the two best meetings on the island. Yours is the other one. I thank Jen for asking me to be chairman this morning. If I'm a little short of breath, some of you will understand. Sonny, I, and Kona will read a vision for you. It's on page 171-173. Sonny, too little, too late. Our speaker today, I did not know her or anything about her. But on Thursday night at the reception, I had a chance to meet and talk with her. She's a lovely lady, a wonderful person to talk to, very understanding, and somebody with a message. Oh, by the way, Jenny saw that I got a tape so that I would have a little bit more understanding. She has a message for us all, and one I think you'll all enjoy. Please help me welcome Fran S. from Redondo Beach, California.
My name's Franny, and I'm an alcoholic. I would appreciate if everybody just took a deep breath right now. This is really very unfair, you know. When you go to these meetings and there's this much feeling and there's this much emotion and there's this much truth, by the time you get to the closing meeting, I got to tell you, you're closed, you know. So, you know, the truth of the matter is I don't need this mic. Any of my babies will tell you that. When I get intense, I get loud, and you can tell from the volume just exactly how much I mean. So, they also told me to speak slowly because they wanted people to understand me. But I have a problem. Even if I speak slow, I'm from New York, and that's just a speech defect from the beginning. So, maybe if I go too fast or too much, the person next to you will be able to translate. I hope so. Anyway, I have to do some preliminary stuff. Do we have any people here from the Santa Cruz area? Okay, I just want every one of you to tell Mike Rutter that he missed a hell of a conference. Okay, that one's taken care of. Do we have anybody here from the Long Beach area? I want all of you to tell David Rutter he missed a hell of a conference. Okay, we got anybody from the South Bay area? I want you to tell my third son, Bill, he missed a hell of a conference too. They're all on the program. That is an absolute gift in my life. I come from an alcoholic family. I created an alcoholic family. We share what we know best. My father was one of those wonderful laughing Irish boys out of New York. And my mother was a society lady, New York society. And they met each other on the steps of Incarnation Church. And they were both beautiful people. I think neither one of them had another thing going for them. But they were gorgeous. Anyway, they spotted each other and they got married and they had three alcoholic kids. And I'm the oldest of the kids. My grandparents are all alcoholic. My kids are all alcoholic. I've been married four times, twice on the program. The first husband was not alcoholic. I was bored. He was a great man. He finally married the babysitter, and she was a little bit like me, and I think now he's happy. He just didn't need as large a dose, that's all. My second husband was alcoholic, and he's in my story, and he believed in King Alcohol, and for the sake of ourselves and the kids, we loved each other enough to let go. And the last two husbands were sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can tell you there is life after sobriety. There is pain. There is love. There is everything you go for. It's all there. So, now my story. My mother didn't take us out in the carriage. We were all three pretty close, and somebody said, "What are your children going to be?" And she didn't say, "This is the doctor, this is the lawyer, and this is the alcoholic." We weren't raised to be alcoholics. We were sent away to private schools, and we were taught all the niceties and the fine things of life, and I hated it. And to keep us away from the elements, see, because the deal is, we had an interesting life. There's a real dichotomy there. My mother taught at Columbia University, and she was a very fine lady. Intuitively, she sat up straight. My father was a gangster, and he was in the rackets in New York. So we had a well-rounded bringing up. I like Daddy. My mother's father used to contribute to, you know, because we always either had an awful lot of money or very little. And self-employment in my father's field was rather hard sometimes. And my mother sent us away to school so that we wouldn't be exposed to that element. But I love Daddy. And then we were sent to private camps in the summer. And my mother thought she had all the bases covered. There were periods of time when I wasn't away at school and I wasn't at camp, and that's when I was running with the kids on the streets. And I learned how to run the streets, and I learned how to run the alleys and the byways of juvenile delinquency, you know. And we used to steal from the cellars of the stores and go back and wash the bottles and bring them back and cash them into the owner. And my life of crime started at the age of 6 and a half. That you know, it's a pretty childish way to start, but it intensified. And I loved it. And at the same time, I loved being where all the floors were slick and polished and there wasn't much furniture and there was a sense of quiet. And there's always, since I've been a child, been a search for some kind of a silent awareness. I believe that alcoholics are spiritually hungry people. We have an appetite for that centering, which we try to either distract because we can't find it, or fill it with another human being. We have a desire for a connection with God, and because we never knew what the target was, we overdid everything. And that's the kind of person that I was. And what happened was, the first time I got drunk, I was 7, and the police went out looking for us because my sister and I disappeared. They found us in a closet the next morning after one of my father's parties. Next time I got drunk, I was 14. And my father was at the height of his drinking in my teens. And I came home, and I lied about my age in a bar. You only have to be 18 anyway to drink in New York. And I came home, and I was feeling really sick, and I threw up all over my bedroom. And I tried to clean it up as best I could, and I just couldn't. I couldn't find the floor. I couldn't find the bed. I couldn't find the bathroom. And then when I found the bed, it didn't feel like I was going to stay on it anyway. And it was just horrible, and I must have just passed out. The next morning, my mother came in to get me up after school. And she opened the door, and she walked into this. And she stood there looking at me with those empty eyes. And I didn't quite get the connection until later on that she saw her oldest daughter starting to repeat the pattern that my father was well into. My mother was trying to get my father to AA in 1940. The next time I got drunk, I got pregnant. And the next time I got drunk, I got married. So, by the time I was 18, somehow or other, the awareness that booze and problems went hand in hand in my life. But never, if you'd asked me at that time, you said, "Are you an alcoholic?" I just said, "Not on your life." And I wound up marrying this nice guy, and we moved to North Hollywood. We left New York to avoid the scandal. My grandmother used to say it. The first one comes any time, the rest take 9 months. And this was the first one, and I didn't know whether my mother would understand or not. And because I was an alcoholic kid, even at that age, I didn't think that the truth was going to be effective. The idea of going to somebody and telling them the truth was not in my style. So we just kept that quiet, got married, pushed the wedding date up real early, and left for California to do what we could. And we did all right. We bought a house eventually in North Hollywood, and I started learning how to be middle class, and I read all the women's magazines, and I looked at all the pictures, and I had the living room just right, and my girlfriends used to come in for a coffee klatch, and they used to serve coffee and sweet rolls. And somehow or other, I thought that was really middle class and tacky. So I would serve cream sherry and biscuits. The women's magazines didn't say anything about coffee and sweet rolls, but they used to show a lot of crystal. And I have since found out, if any of you are still reading those things, you know, show me one of those magazines that's got a dirty husband coming in growly from work. Show me one of those magazines that's got three kids playing on the floor just before the company arrives, you know? They're all a fantasy, and I bought into it. I was into a fantasy. He used to come home from work, and the ladies had left, and I had finished the cream sherry, and he would say, "Where's my supper?" And I would be lying on the couch, and I would be checking my eyelids for light leaks, you know? So whenever we had our coffee klatch, when it was my turn, it was also his turn to take the kids out for hamburgers. So we had a good working arrangement, only he was getting tired of it fast. And we bought a house in Redondo Beach, and then we moved there to be closer to the income property. We were on our way up, and I'm on my way down. And one time there was a time for a birthday party. And we've been at the beach a couple of years now. My daughter was 9. My oldest son was going to celebrate his 8th birthday. And the kids were excited. And Ray said, "I'm going to go to work and I'm going to come home early and we'll have the house ready and let's have a nice little family birthday party for the kids." I said, "That, yeah, sure, you know, you don't have, sure." And in the meantime, I had gotten into the beach crowd down on the beach, and this was in the 60s. And, you know, we were all running around happy and hairy. You know? Peace. You know? And I threw my gloves and my hats and my handbags away and learned how to wear something sloppy and cut totem poles out of phone poles at the on the beach and dive for quarters that people threw from the pier. And my kids were developing good ankles because they were running barefoot. They didn't have shoes. And I spent a lot of time up on the pier drinking Mai Tais, talking to my good friend and philosophical counselor, the bartender at Tony's on the pier. And so I said, "Yeah," I said, "no sweat. You know, I'll we'll whip something together." And so as soon as he went to work, you know, it was time to take the kids to the beach. He came home from work and he looked around and there was nothing done. He knew where I was. I was always there. So he came down the beach and he was mad. I wasn't on the beach, the kids were, as usual, alone and unsupervised. So he came up to the pier and he found me in my bar and he dragged me off that bar stool and he just pulled me, kicking and screaming, down the Redondo Pier in front of all my fine friends. To the end of the pier. And the kids are down there standing there, big-eyed and worried, and there's the car, and there's the kids, and there's Daddy, and Mommy's not looking good. And have you ever tried to put yourself into some semblance of dignity in the midst of chaos? And I pulled myself up straight, and I said, pulled out a couple of bucks and handed it to my daughter, who was 9. She was the head of the little troop that I had. And I said, "Annie, you buy the kids ice cream and then you bring them home. I don't want you kids riding with us in seeing how your father abuses me. So he threw me in the car, and we drove off to the house, and she took the kids and went to get ice cream. We got to the house, and the phone rang, and to this day, I don't know who answered it. And I had the phone to my ear. Anyway, I had it, and her voice is saying, "Mommy, I don't know what happened. We bought the ice cream, and Buddy was sitting on the railing of the pier, and we don't know whether he was pushed or he fell. Buddy went over into the water, and we can't find him." And I know what it's like to be just moved physically and emotionally, in spite of what's going on and in spite of what condition I'm in, into a position of absolute, cold, mechanical sobriety. Bah! It was there. My kid was in danger. I was the one that drove the car back down to the beach. We only lived two blocks from the beach. I was the one that started going into the water, and a Samoan friend of mine grabbed me from behind and pushed me down. I'm an Olympic quality swimmer. He pushed me down in the sand, and I was kneeling there, and he said, "My God, don't you find him?" And I sat there with him holding me by the shoulders, watching that water. And one of the guys came walking out holding my kid. The resuscitation unit was already there. They started working on him, kept working on him. I went with the ambulance. We went up to South Bay Hospital. They have the kid in the emergency. I'm standing against the wall on one side, outside the emergency room. He's standing on that wall facing me. Both of us are looking at each other with our arms closed, waiting to find out if our oldest son is dead. Alcoholism and my behavior had created such a situation in that family that we could not hold each other and comfort and solace each other while we waited to find out what happened to our oldest 8-year-old boy. We couldn't reach out to each other, and we couldn't touch each other. You want to know about shivering denizens of King Alcohol's realm? And if you'd asked me at that point, "Are you an alcoholic?" I would have said, "Of course not." And I'm leaning against this wall, and I remember what was going through my mind. "Hey, God, listen, I don't know what you're doing, but don't punish this kid because I'm a rotten mother. Don't take his life away because I'm an incompetent human being. Don't make him pay because I didn't know how to do it. I would give up anything. This was my favorite." I said, "I would even stop drinking." And I waited. And I was bargaining as fast and as hard and as sincerely as I could for that child's life. And I was putting up the most precious thing I had in exchange for it, if it would be taken. And if you'd asked me at that point, "Are you an alcoholic?" I would have said, "Of course not." The doctor came out. I knew. And we went home, and Ray was a normal human being. He grieved. He fell to pieces, and he went to bed for a couple of days, and he couldn't do anything. I walked in, and I started cooking supper, and then I called the kids in to eat, because that's what you do. And people came around, and they brought food, and I'm sitting there in my black dress and in my black velvet hat, barefooted, worrying about making sure that everybody had coffee. You want to know about denial? For 6 months, I was still setting a place for that kid, and I was still calling him into supper. Ray came to me and he said, I can't stand this. I talked to some psychologist friends of mine, and they said that you're dangerous. I'm filing for divorce, and I'm going to try to take the kids away from you. Because you're a psychopathic deviant, and you're obviously a dangerous and incompetent mother. And I agreed with him, but he wasn't going to get the kids. So for 2 years, we went through a divorce attempt, and I had it all arranged. I had the tickets ready and everything the day that we went down to get the judge's decision on this divorce, because I had everything ready to go to British Columbia with those kids. There was no problem. Nobody's taking my kids away from me. What had happened was that poor man was only moving on the information that he had. I'd already been declared a psychopathic deviant by 2 different medical boards, neither of which knew the other one had said the same thing. He was the only human being that knew that. And all he wanted to do was protect the remaining children. I had no idea about that. I only wanted to keep mine. So he was out of the house now, and what happened was there were no more external controls left. There were certainly no internal controls. And I drank like there was just not going to be enough. There was nobody to tell me don't do it. And if anybody around me told me don't do it, of course, how can you say that to me? This is a double tragedy. I lost my kid, and now the old man's gone. How can you tell me to stop? And I want to tell you something, because I have to tell the truth up here. The increase in my drinking at that time had nothing to do with the tragedy. The reason I drank the way I did was because I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I drank more was because the controls were off. And if I be absolutely factual about this, I took full advantage of my kid's death to stop you from trying to control me also. And I finally had an opportunity to drink exactly the way I needed to drink to make this world tolerable. Eventually it phased out a little bit, it eased off just a little bit. He was out of the picture, and I knew that I had to find some kind of a job. I was a barmaid, and this hip, slick German accent, Oklahoma Indian, if you want an explanation on that one later, I'll tell you, comes walking in, and this guy played pool the same way I did, and he drank the same way I did, and I thought to myself, my God, what a gem. So I married him, and 9 months later, I had another kid. And when that baby was 6 months old, this man is standing there in the doorway looking at me with these steely eyes. We had lots of Samsonite drills. He's in, he's out, I'm in, I'm out, you know. One time I got really mad at him, I said, you can't leave, it's my turn. He was as wild as I was, you know. This baby was 6 months old. He's standing in the door and he's saying to me, I can't take this game. I'm gone. And he walked away. And he had all my money in his pocket. And, you know, here I am. I'm a year and 6 months after doing whatever. And I got to tell you something. I couldn't work. I had to find a man to support me, my children, my house, and my habit. It was very simple. He had to be good-looking, rich, and stupid. Those are the requirements. This guy was stupid by virtue of his own alcoholism. I loved him for it. I had to do something to get his attention. I had to let him know I wanted to save this sick situation. I really cared about it. So I thought to myself, what can I do? Now, I remember my mother going through some dramatic stuff trying to get Daddy to AA. And I thought, okay, I didn't call a priest, I didn't call a minister, I didn't call a marriage counselor, I didn't call any of those people that had tried to help me in the past. I called AA, and I said, you got these meetings? They said, yeah. I said, you want to come to the meeting? I, I said, yeah, when is it and where is it? And they told me. They said, we'll send somebody for you. I said, oh, no. No. No, I'll get there myself. Thank you very much. I mean, I didn't know if I could trust these people that were willing to put me in a car and take me someplace. So I went ahead and put on my 79-cent pair of Zoris because I wore shoes for social occasions. And I put on my camel-colored corduroy jeans. And I'll tell you something. A camel color, if there's anybody here who intends to go out and drink again, beige. Beige is a good color. It's neither too dark nor too light. You know, it's that medium range. You can fall in the mud and dry off, brush off, and it just looks like an interesting shadow pattern. You know how that goes. So I had these corduroy jeans, and they fit me, and that made them mine. I took a 15-and-a-half man shirt because I did my shopping in the men's section in Goodwill. And I put that shirt on, and there was a button missing, so I buttoned it. I pinned it very carefully from the inside. Modesty and decorum at all times. And I had a sweater that I'd stolen from Goodwill because I couldn't afford to buy it. I had a broken nose and two black eyes. And this was in 1967, and my hair was out to here. And I was simply 20 years ahead of the time, that's all. I went and got that big old clunker that I rode around in, and I went to the gas station and put 25 cents worth of gas in it. I used to drink incrementally, and I used to fuel the car incrementally. And after I bought a half pint, and then another half pint, whatever I had left, the kids and I used to go down to the beach and scoop up bottles and take them home and cash them in. And I got in that car, and I went up to that Manhattan Beach Club, and I stood outside that club, and I'm looking in the window. They had these louvered windows. They're open. And I'm watching the action. Okay. And people would saunter in, and they'd say, hi. And they'd put their money on, and a quarter or whatever, a dime, I don't remember. And the guy would take a cup and give him coffee. And I said, yeah, I can do that. And you see, is there anybody else here who gets ready to go out and party by drinking so they're ready to go out and party? Well, this was obviously a social situation, so you know how I had prepared to go to my first meeting, right? I was feeling strong and hopeful and secure. I think it took a half a roll of Benny's and a half a pint of scotch. This was about the way I did it. And I remember that my hand was shaking because I was trying to put mascara on and I was trying to use makeup to hide the bruises on my face. And I stood there looking at it, and I took another drink. And it wasn't that my hand got more secure as I drank. It was just that the mirror wasn't as clear, so it looked better. You know, that's the way I got ready. And anyway, there I was, ready to walk in. So by God, I did. I walked into that meeting, and I had my cup of coffee, and I looked around, and I already told you what I looked like. And I wondered if these people were going to live up to my expectations. And I sat myself somewhere near front center. I had to watch it. I had to study it. If I'm going to be involved with it. See, my whole intention was to find two of the biggest guys there, take them home, straighten him out. That was my intention. Anyway, this guy named Frank P., who's something like 35 years of sobriety now, got up, and it was a newcomer's meeting. Half talk, and then half questions and answers. So he talked, and it was the craziest thing I ever heard. Mailman ran off with somebody's wife, and everybody applauded, and a house, you know, and then a house burned down, and that really brought a laugh, you know. And I was absolutely fascinated. I couldn't really afford a television, and this looked good. So after he got finished with that stuff he was going through and gone, and well, I don't know, it was wild. Then he says, does anybody here have any questions? Now. It was real important for me to let this room full of people know that the circumstances that brought me there as an absolute, unsullied, innocent victim of circumstance, had been created by him. It was very important for me to make sure that you knew that I was okay. And alcoholics, cunning, baffling, and powerful as is the disease, in one question, I established my position. I raised my hand, and he said, "Yes." I said, "How do I get my old man to stop beating me?" And he said, "I haven't had that experience since I got sober, but there's a lady here that can share her experience, strength, and hope." And he called Indian Genie to come up to the podium and share. So Genie comes waltzing up to the podium, and she leans on it, and she says, "My name's Genie, and I'm an alcoholic. And any son of a bitch that lays a hand on me, now that I'm sober, is going to get a knife right in the gut." I said, "Hot dog, these people have the answers." And I stayed for the next meeting, and I stayed for the midnight meeting, and then I went home. And I went and I got the biggest knife I had. And I washed it, and I took the steel wool, and I cleaned it, and I dried it, and I put it right there on the counter, and I waited for him to come home so I could introduce him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came slithering in about 3 o'clock. And I had that poor man backed up against the wall with the knife in a critical point right under his chin, babbling wildly about being a child of God and a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And now that I'm a lady, and I got it all together, and this is what you're gonna do. And as soon as the knife was gone, he was too. I didn't care, man, I found it. I went to a meeting the next morning, I went to a meeting the next afternoon, I went to the Saturday night meeting. You know, I went to we call it the wrist slashes now, so you know how much I enjoyed it. You know, I went to the Sunday morning meeting and got immediately spiritual. He had to come home Monday because, after all, he had to change his clothes to go to work. I didn't care. I stayed sober on fear, fellowship, and a high-sugar diet. I was in those meetings, and I was going strong, and I was learning all the words. And, man, I was standing outside the club a lot, dragging my foot and popping my fingers and telling funny stories. And you know what happened? That lasted about, I don't know, some number of months, and I got struck drunk. And I couldn't figure out what happened. So I thought, yeah, I've got to learn the words, got to learn the words. So I went back and I studied the book, and I have eidetic memory. And I got into that book and I learned it all. And you know what happened? Tremendous defense. Nobody could get near me. Somebody would come up to me and they'd start saying something. I would complete the line and smile at them like, "Go ahead, try again." Alcoholics are funny, you know. We come from a point of absolute fear. And that's the one thing we're just unwilling to talk about. What happens is we get scared, then we get angry, and then we react. And then we get scared, angry, react. And finally what happens is we get scared and we react and everybody thinks it's anger. The basis for every problem I've ever had has been fear. And the hardest thing I've ever worked to conceal in my life has been fear. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong. I was afraid to let you near me. In the course of 3 years, in and out, in and out, in and out, I kept showing up, and I want to tell you something. There's only one mistake you can make around this program, and that's not to come back. I look back on it now, and I realize I was a pathological liar, and I was such a phony that what I was doing in every cycle that I was coming in and coming out, coming in and coming out, I was losing more and more. People used to go to meetings when I was first in, and they would talk about having been to hospitals and having been to institutions and having been to jails. And I would say, I've never been to a hospital for that. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. And then they would talk about jails, and I would say, I've never been in a jail for that. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. But in the course of the 3 years when I first came around this program and started putting my first year together, three times in one jail, once in five other jails, and six hospitals, and I don't know how many times. One time in an emergency hospital, a doctor was sewing my face up again, and he started crying. And I looked at him. I'm sitting on the table, you know. You reach a point. I never had any emergency treatment except between 2 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning. And he's sitting there, and he's sewing her face up again. And I said to him, why are you crying? He says, you don't know what it's like to be repairing the stitches that I just took out last week. And he's crying. And he's sewing me up again. And I said to him, shut up and do what you're supposed to do. With this thread hanging down my face while he's wiping his face. And he did. At the end of that period of 3 years, nobody in the club talked to me. Hi, Franny, how are you? But it was not like anybody wanted anything I had. There had been such a deterioration that I started a lot of sentences I never finished, and I didn't have that car anymore, and I didn't have that old man around anymore. And my kids had found other resources. They had to live there, but they were surviving because they were children of alcoholics. And all that stuff that I used to say, I could do it if I didn't have to worry about this. I could do it if I didn't have to worry about that. And God said, fine, you'll help. And this was gone, and that was gone, and there wasn't much left to complain about. I had no more problems of abundance. There was nothing in the way between me and sobriety. And there was this lady that used to come to these meetings. And, you know, she'd walk in, and she always had an entourage. And I looked at her, and people loved her, and she was clean, and she had a real good-looking old man. And I wanted what she had. Not necessarily him, but the same model. And I went to her one time, and I said, Dottie, would you be my sponsor? And she looked at me and she said, I don't know, Franny, you're a loser. And I said something I hadn't said. Please, I don't want to die. She said, well, she held her hand out, and one of her lieutenants put a directory in her hand, you know. Somebody else handed her a pen. She said, these are the meetings I go to. I'll see you there. And she walked away. I had a sponsor. So I went to those meetings. I didn't go near her for 6 months. But I would sit all the way as far away from her as I could. And I would say, that's my sponsor. And I got turned on. I felt like I'd done something right. And I started going to a lot of the meetings that she went to, and you know, eventually, simply numbers eventually get to you. They started calling on me. And after the first 3 times they called on me, she said, enough of this. She made me sit next to her. And I'd say, my name's a Franny, and I'm an alcoholic. And when I take a deep breath, she'd hit me in the ribs real hard, and I would go, phew. And then she'd say, thank you, and they would call on somebody else. And what happened was, eventually there was this little Indian gal that was real sick, and man, I was in there. And you know, I fell into a group that did not work the steps. See, it was not a dumping therapeutic situation. We talked about what was going on in terms of progress and recovery. And for me to contribute anything to that group, besides my own stupid, funny stories and my own tragedy, I had to get involved in the big book and start working the steps so that I could do something, because they would say to me, "What step are you on? Hi, Franny, how are you? What step are you on?" This was our greeting. Somebody said, "Do you like that?" "No." "What step are you on? What are you going to have for supper now that we're having a coffee break after the meeting? What step are you on? You want to go to the meeting with me tomorrow night? I'll pick you up. What step are you on?" I started feeling real thick, you know? So I went to her. I said, "What do I do?" She says, "Work the steps." I said, "I don't know how. Read the book." Okay, I had word blindness. I would read one paragraph. It didn't make any sense. I could stand there. I could read it perfectly to you. One paragraph. They would say, "Okay, what'd you read?" Wait a minute. And I would go back and I'd try again. By bit, little tiny baby steps. People held my hand and they walked me through, and I would start making, start trying to say something. And I would go blank. I would forget what I was saying. And somebody would finish the sentence for me and they would be accurate. And I started having a sense of feeling safe. And one time, this lady came to the meeting and she talked about some horrible stuff that had happened. I never saw her again. And I realized it was okay to talk about the fact that my oldest son had died, had been killed during a drunken argument. And somebody said to me one time, "Why are you so afraid of that?" I said, "Because it's such a horrible thing to carry." She said, "But why are you carrying it alone?" And I said, "Because my husband and I knew that it's my fault. I'm the alcoholic." She said, "Wait a minute." She said, "Forget the alcoholic stuff." She says, "You are both the parents." I said, "Yeah." She said, "It was part of him too." I said, "You really mean that?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, what do I do with it?" She says, "You learn to live with it. It's a fact of your life. And someday you're going to tell your story and somebody's going to hear it and know it's okay to have made mistakes, but they're still child of God." And I started being able to talk about that. And I started being able to talk about all my other filthy, slimy little secrets. And I started being able to admit to my foolishness. And eventually what happened was, 6 months of sobriety, you know, I started cleaning my house. And when I hit the third step, after I took the third step, I was filled with the power of God. And I went to my sponsor, and I knew that my mission was going to be to go save alcoholic souls in China, at least. And I went to her and I said, "Dottie, now that I've worked the third step, what do I do with it?" She says, "Go home and clean your house." I didn't want pragmatic solutions. I wanted somebody to make me a big sign that said, "Spiritual." Which meant that I was so spiritual, I was no earthly good. That's okay. People would admire me. They'd ask my opinion. I'd be sponsoring thousands by mail. You know, I had these visions. "Go home and clean your house." So I stormed out of her house, as I did at least once a day. Her door was fixed. You couldn't slam it. Her husband put this big fat stop on it because he got tired of all these dramatic, flaky females swinging in and swinging out. So I went home and I looked, and I had these big double sink in this old beach house. And I hadn't seen the bottom of that sink in 6 months. My daughter had stopped doing her chores. So I said, "Well..." And I got the dish soap, and I got the steel wool, and I got whatever I had to get, and I got the hot water going, and I'd scrub, and then I'd take the plate, and I'd smash it in the other sink. And I'd take it, and I'd scrub it again, and I'd look at it, it's clean, and I'd smash it in the other sink. And you know, eventually, after about maybe 25 or 30 minutes of that, I looked, and I had a sink. And there's this green stuff all over the bottom. So I said, "Well, all right." And I took the Comet, and I sprinkled it, and I cleaned it all up. And I stood back after I rinsed it all off, and I realized I had a clean slate. And you know what? I felt that much better about myself. That was the first little tiny taste of self-respect. That was the beginning of my recovery, the willingness, unwillingly, to clean my dishes. And I felt so good that I cleaned all the broken ones out, and I threw them away, and I took out the trash. And then I got into the fourth step, and, you know, I was supposed to do it, but I was sort of like, you know, wafting around on the breeze, talking about making sure I'd done my third step. It seems to me that most of the people that really talk about having difficulty with the third step are really in an avoidance pattern on the fourth, you know? It's only a decision. But, you know, I used it. We all do. And I was cleaning one of my cabinets one time, and I found a half a pint of vodka. And there was a half an inch in the bottom of it. And I stood there looking at it. And I thought, what do I do? And I walked over to the sink, and I opened the lid, and I threw it in the trash. And I held the bottle up, and I drank it. And I walked over to the trash, and just as I dropped the bottle into the trash, a friend of mine, Jim B., came walking into the house and said, "Hey, you ready for the noon meeting?" And I went, whew. And what went through my head was, "Oh, God, I'm glad it's vodka." And I went to the meeting with him, and we were in the meeting, and somebody talked about the fact that when you start a drunk, you've got to complete it. And I got so scared. And it was the first time that I realized I wanted sobriety more than I wanted drunk. And it was the first time that I realized the inevitability of my position without some kind of spiritual program. And I sat there and I shook in my boots because I had started another drunk and I had to finish it. And I didn't want to tell anybody that I didn't have 6 months anymore. So I kept my dirty little secret the same way I always kept my dirty little secrets. And I carried it with me. And then one time we were going to Santa Maria for a conference, and somebody said, "Isn't this great? Granny's finally got some time. She's coming with us." And I realized I didn't have any. So I wrote a phony fourth step and embedded that one fact in there. And then I sat down with my sponsor, Dottie, and I went, blah, 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 and then I did this, and then I did that. And yeah, I took a half an ounce of vodka, and I went, blah, 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 and she said, "Stop." Roll that back. So I said, "Okay, I don't have," and I mentioned the time, I don't remember what it was. And she said, "Everybody in the group is moving on the assumption that you have that time." I said, "Yeah, I know." She said, "What are you going to do about it?" I said, "Lie." She said, "No." She said, "We're going to have the meeting tonight." No, she said, "We're going to have the meeting Thursday night. I've done this on a Saturday. So we're going to have the meeting Thursday night, and you're going to, when you're called on, you're going to tell the group how much time you really have. Hey, listen, this group was my life. I had gone through life lying and cheating and stealing and keeping concealed anything that I thought might turn you off about me. And now she's telling me this one God-given thing that I finally had. I'm going to have to take a risk and let them know who and what I am and what I'm really about. And maybe they're going to reject me, and yeah, that's okay. You've got to do it." So she led the meeting that Thursday night, and it was a two-hour meeting. Sometimes it went over. And I want you to know she left me second to last. She let me stew in my own juices through that entire meeting. I thought she was going to call on me early and get it over with, because we always called on the newcomers, then the middle kids, and then the old-timers to resolve any problems. No, she slid right over me, and I thought for a minute, good, she forgot. No, she never forgets. You know? And I just sat there and stood, and finally she called on me, and I said, "I'm a real ass. This is what I did." And I told them the truth, and they agreed I was an ass, and they loved me. And nobody threw any rocks.
They started treating me the same way they treated me, and I found out that what I had to do was to simply keep walking and talking the way I saw them walk and talk, and fake it till I could make it, you know. Talk the talk and walk the walk, and finally it would become real, and I said, yeah, I'm trying. Anyway, I went back and I took a real first, second, and third step. I started working the fourth step. I took a fifth step, and one day this little Indian gal walks in and she says to me, I have 9 real months now. She says, Franny, I want you to be my sponsor. And the only response that I had was, my God, you must be sick. And she said, no. She said, I identify with you. She said, Dottie says that God is keeping me real busy by all the stuff going on, and I want you for my sponsor. I said, okay. And I started sponsoring her. One time, one of the guys walked into my house, and Becky has her head down on the dining room table, sobbing out loud, just wretched. And I'm standing over her, pounding on the table and yelling at her, we will enjoy life! What happened was I met a really neat guy. And he was in the Navy, and he wanted to marry me. I said, no. No. I don't want anymore. But what happened was, he was getting transferred to Hawaii, so I figured it was God's will that we get married. We do that. We do that. We bring God in as a part of the supporting cast. So we were married 3 weeks, and we came over here, and he dropped me on the rock, and he took off on a Westpac. And I settled right in Waipahu, and I started going to meetings. Yeah! I started going to meetings, and I had me and the kids in this chintzy little apartment. It wasn't Navy housing up in Waipahu. And man, I was just roaring down the meetings and roaring out to Eva the meetings and finding out what all of this was. I was in my first year of sobriety. I had just celebrated a year, I think. Anyway, what happened was, I'm going to meetings now. All my life, I had been somebody's daughter, somebody's wife, somebody's mother. And all of a sudden, this is the first time in my life, I have 2 of my kids with me. The other 2 went with their dad. And I have 2 of these kids with me, and they're both in school. And for the first time in life, I can't play any game except I am me, I am responsible for me, and what am I going to do about it? And I went down and I got myself a real job, and I got paid real money, and I came home to my real apartment, and I wound up going to real meetings and talking with real people and feeling like one of the big kids. And one time, I was out at a meeting in Eva, and you know, I think you understand that I came out of a real hard-nosed group, right? So what happened is, they don't know how much I was really the baby of the group, and I knew all the words. So we're sitting at this really kickback meeting in Eva, and we're talking about what it really takes to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, as far as I'm concerned, the only people who are really members of Alcoholics Anonymous are people who are really into the steps and who are really doing 12-step work and who are showing up and doing it and staying sober and spreading the message and da-da-da-da-da. I was a little tiny dragon, and every now and then I'd breathe a little smoke, you know. And this lady named Marge said to me, when it was her turn to speak, she didn't even rebut it. She said, my God, Franny, I'm sure glad you cleared that up. I always thought that the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. And I suddenly realized that maybe I should keep my big mouth shut and listen. And I did. And the greatest growth that I had was acting on the responsibilities that I had put in front of me. And I was by myself, and I thanked God for that aloneness, because I really got into prayer and meditation, and I got into some real growth that was not the outside kind. And while I was doing that, my oldest son joined a Samoan group down in Pearl City and started running around beating up sailors with baseball bats. and the younger son started demonstrating extremely negative behavior in school. And what happened was I didn't know what to do with them, and this kid was these kids were really just crazy. So I wound up getting them involved in a martial arts class over in Waikahu, over the general market, and I got involved too. And it was the first thing my kids and I had ever done together. We learned how to beat each other up. And he eventually came back from his Westpac, and he didn't know what to do with me. He would say, well, I think you ought to do. And I said, no, I don't. That's not the way we're doing it. What we're doing is, and I would lay it out. And he had this child bride on his hands, and all of a sudden the child bride is turning into like something else. And then what happens is we moved to San Diego because the ship got transferred against my wishes. God didn't listen. I was really put out. And what we wound up doing was sitting around in the living room one time down in San Diego talking about working with people and how this group up in Redondo Beach used to do it. And these kids said, let's do it. And I said, do what? And they said, start a group like that. I said, no, it's too much trouble. They say, you can't say anything about it. You're only the sponsor. We're starting it and you tell us what to do. Oh, my Lord. They went out. See, this kind of group that I'm talking about, it's all the rebels. It's the ones that nobody wants in the club and everybody else can't stand. You ever see those people? I mean, we got them. They come walking and everybody says, oh. And those were the ones we accumulated. And those are the ones that grew and blossomed in our sandy, enthusiastic soil. We had the Cactus Brigade. And what happened was, these guys had so many rough little edges on them that the only thing I could think of was in terms of lapidary work. You know, you take all these rocky little stones with these edges and these things sticking out. You throw them into this big old tumbler. You put some grit in called the 12 steps. You slam the thing shut and you turn it on and they bounce off each other until they smooth out. And you know, the amazing thing is that they kept attracting more and more people. I couldn't sponsor them all. I said, I sponsor you. You go sponsor those new guys. And they did. And we started doing things together and we were all learning together. I want you to know something. At the time that this thing happened in San Diego, I had 3 years of sobriety. I figure this way. It's okay. Bill Wilson started AA with a week, so. And eventually what happened is I wound up going to Iowa. And I went to Iowa State. I took a job as a shoemaker and I was busting my hands making shoes, and I was building orthopedic cowboy shoes, and I'm real good with boots and saddles. I'm a craftsman. And one day I looked at what I was doing, and I said, you know, this is not what I want. So I quit the job, and I went up to Iowa State University. No, I went to the local junior college, and I said, I want to get in your psychology program. What do I do, and how do I do it? And by the way, I don't have any money. And they said, come on back, we'll talk to you. And I got a grant, and I got some other stuff. And I wound up going to school, and I was really scared because I knew I had brain damage. Remember I told you I couldn't read and then tell you what I read? So I was real scared because I was afraid that if they gave me those grants and scholarships and you found out how retarded I really was, you would take them away. So I fooled you. I carried a straight A average, and nobody ever figured out I was retarded. And I went through the whole thing still feeling like a phony. And just when I was ready to do my practicum and go work with crippled children, because that's what I was doing, I was into human services, I wound up getting rear-ended on an icy road in Iowa, and my car was caught between two great big cars, the smallest of which was a Monte Carlo. And my car was accordion pleated with me in it, and they had to use the jaws of life to cut the car apart to pull me out, and they didn't believe my back wasn't broken. And they took me out on a board, and I'm lying there, and I'm conscious, and I'm trying to tell them how to do it. And one of the guys puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says, I have the certificate. Let me do it. And they got me out of there on that backboard, and they brought me into the ambulance. But he also knew that I was worthy of respect, and that I was intensely interested in the procedure. So he leaned over to me and he said, "Would it bother you if we used the siren?" And I said, "No, go ahead." So they get me down to the hospital and they sewed my knees up. And what happened was both my knees and my hips were crushed in this accident. And that what they wanted me to do was a lot of bed rest and eventually some kind of surgery. And they assured me with the surgery, after the surgery and years of physical rehabilitation, that I would, with luck, have 40% mobility. And I thought about it and I said, "I'm not going to lie down and size up. I got my midterms coming up, and I'm going to go back to school. So you do to me whatever you do, need to do to keep me on my feet." And they said, "It's going to hurt." I said, "That's nothing new." So I did not give in. I guess that's the only way to say it. And I said, "Okay, God, here we go." Now, I had a prayer, and I still have it, and I say it every morning. "Dear God, please don't let me get us into anything you can't get us out of." And there's another prayer that's by Sir Thomas More, and it says, "Lord, I shall be very busy this day. I may forget thee. Do not thou forget me." And I said those prayers every day, and I used to have to walk up 2 flights of stairs to go to my classes. Obviously, I could not do my practicum. Obviously, I could not get my certificate in human services. The practicum was required, was mandated. What was I going to do now? And I went to my main professor, and I said, "Jan, what am I going to do?" I said, "You know, the contract was that I was going to get my AA degree and be self-sufficient and be able to support myself, because it's obvious the marriage is over. I got a kid to take care of. I got no way to make a living. I mean, who's going to hire anybody that can't walk with an AA in liberal arts? I mean, that's not exactly a certificate in some saleable skill." She says, "That's a real disadvantage. It's a possibility that maybe the only thing you got left to do is go up to the university and see if you can complete your 4 years." And I said, "Why would I do that?" She says, "Because you haven't got anything else you can do, stupid. Go to school." So I thought, well, and I really felt like God took something away from me. And what I wound up doing was reluctantly going up to Iowa State University and getting mixed up with the worst, meanest, snarliest, most brilliant professor on the campus. What happened was he gave us a test, and I stood up in the back of the class and told him everything that was wrong with the experiments that he'd given us to check, and I found out later that they were all designed by him. And he said to me, when I finished my tirade, because he dared to give me a C, he said, "I'll see you in my office right after this class." And I thought, oh my God, they're going to take it all away, me and my mouth. And I went into his office and he said, "What's your problem?" I said, "You scared me." He said, "How can I scare you by giving you a C?" I said, "I have to get A's. If I don't get A's, I don't get scholarships. And if I don't get scholarships, then I'm no good. And I don't know how to do anything except get A's." He said, "Have you ever been a subject for any psychological examination?" I said, "No." I said, "But I want to design series in experimental psychology, and I want to work on the brain." I said, "I spent 12 years in bars lying about being a brain specialist, and that's what I want to be, because I'm crippled and I can't do anything else." He said, "Okay, you want to go to work for me?" He's the guy that writes books on cognitive psychology. I said, "Yeah, how much are you going to pay? And if we publish anything, do I get authorship?" He gave me $93 a month, and my name was last on anything we published. And he put me in charge of a lab, and I started running experiments, and I started getting into the cutting edge of brain function, the technology of human intelligence. And I'm up there saying to myself, I'm flying around the country giving speeches on cognition. I'm teaching as part member of a course. I haven't got a degree yet. I had my own office on that university. The kids used to walk in and call me Dr. Hart. And I asked my sponsor there, I said, what should I do? He said, just keep your mouth shut and remember that you're not. Don't embarrass the kids. I said, okay. So I'm running these tests, and I'm publishing these papers, and I'm flying around making my presentations. And, you know, it's like, I can't believe what's going on. And I'm starting to realize that whatever you go for, you can get. You can get. And I don't know what I'm going to do with all these skills I learned about brain function. And my mother got real sick. And she called me up. She said, Franny, she said, I want you to know the truth. She says, I called Ann and I called Pat before I called you. But neither one of them can come and take care of me. I have cancer of the lung and I need help. I said, I'll be there. So I went back and I worked with my mother and she was able to recover from that. But it turned into cancer of the brain. And I worked with her and I lived with her for a year. And by that time, my mother had 9 years of sobriety on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my home group. She had called me when I was living in Hawaii, and she said, Franny, she said, please, I need help. I know I'm an alcoholic. And I wrote a letter back. I didn't call her, and I said, Mom, I said, you really are. You had to wait until I'm 3,000 miles away before you say help. I said, I'll tell you what you do. You go, you talk to my sponsor. She writes back, she says, I can't talk to Dottie. I haven't got a thing to say to her. I write back, I say, yes, you do. You tell her you're my mother and you can both complain about me. So that's what she did. She died with 9 years of sobriety. And she maintained her dignity right up until the end. And I believe that everything that I had learned, the purpose for that was so that I could help that lady walk with grace and dignity into what she anticipated and knew. And she was an absolute model for all of us. And she taught me in her last year what life was about. You know, I believe any of you guys, Catholics and non-Catholics alike, you see a lot of them on dashboards, the Good Shepherd. You know that statue of the Good Shepherd, that guy from Israel that's got the little lamb hanging over his shoulders? Come on, react. Do you know him or not? All right. I don't know whether you're comatose or hypnotized. I need reaction. Okay, he's standing there and he's got this little lamb hanging over his shoulders. That lamb is not there because it's happier with him than with its mother. The reason that happens, and I found this out from a guy from Israel, the shepherds still do it. Lots of times, one of the ewes has a lamb, and the lamb is contrary. That's, you know, like Mary, Mary, quite contrary. That the word contrary goes with lambs. What happens is these lambs don't stay with the herd. They don't bond. And what happens is they run around and they fall off cliffs. And they wind up getting caught by wolves. It's a hard life. So the shepherd goes and gets this pig-headed, obstinate creature, this baby, and he breaks one of its hind legs. Then he puts it over his shoulders and he holds the leg straight. The lamb can't do any damage to itself and they're growing and they heal real fast. And he carries that lamb with its broken leg until it attaches to him. At which point he puts the lamb down and the lamb does not go away to die. The lamb stays and grows and flourishes. That's what the Good Shepherd is about. And I believe that my higher power is a good shepherd. I believe that everything that happened to me that I always... that always seemed seemingly negative experiences was because there was a purpose, there was a pattern, there was a direction, and the pain really came from me resisting God's will. I do not believe that there is pain when I am going with the flow. we got a heck of a group. I believe that mine is one of the two best groups in AA. And you know the other one's yours. I heard that a long time ago, and I realized that if I thought that it was second best, that I was being satisfied with second best again. And early on, when I was new in the program, my sponsor said to me, you never have to be second best again, and you never have to accept second best. And one time I was speaking at a meeting, and it was one of those speaker meetings, and when I came down from the podium, there was a guy that wanted to meet me, because I was talking about some of the stuff that I was doing, and I didn't get into it at any length, but he recognized that I was right out there on that cutting edge of technology with the brain, and he had studied with Shannon at MIT with artificial intelligence, and he wanted to take me out for dinner and talk about this big kid stuff. So he asked me out for dinner, and you know, we never talk business. I got even with him. I married him. And I'm married to my best friend. I really am. And what we have today is a life where we learn. I have contributed tremendously to his program. I have given him an opportunity daily to practice all the principles. And every now and then, when it gets a little wild, one or the other of us will go up to the other one and we'll say, are we all right? Yeah, we're fine. You know, right now I can't stand you, but we're fine. Okay. And he doesn't get into the game. And I don't get into the game. When I came into this program, after I got sober, and after I started sponsoring some women, I figured something out. The newcomer women that come in are all gorgeous and all thick. They're all baby barracudas. They got one purpose in life, and that's to find somebody to fix it. And remember I said my requirement for a man was good looking, with money, and stupid enough to go for me? My sponsor said to me one time, we were talking about it, my girlfriends had boyfriends, and I went to Dottie and I said, Dottie, must I remain celibate for the rest of my life? She said, maybe. But she said, be grateful for this time alone because it gives you time to work on yourself. And anyway, anybody who'd be attracted to you at this point, as sick as you are, isn't worth your time. I'm still sponsoring people. They give me what I need. You know, I really don't know what a big spiritual message is. I don't know how to talk particularly well in concepts and abstracts, because for me, that's like icing. The sugar feels good immediately, but when you walk away, what have you really got? The program tells us that we share our experience, strength, and hope. And my experience in strength and hope is that I came out from underneath the bridge and I wound up doing what you did. And I found out that this is a totally spiritual program and that what happened is I'm walking and talking the way I really wanted to all the time. I always wanted to grow up and be right on. Every now and then when I have a problem and I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen here and I don't really know what to do, I do what the book tells us to do. I pause and I wait. Sometimes the direction is given. Sometimes it's just a feeling. But all the time, when I pause and wait, it's better than moving immediately into a mess. You know, sometimes I pause and wait and do the wrong thing. And that's okay, because this program is not about avoiding mistakes. It's not that you get sober and all of a sudden you never make another mistake. I don't know where we got that. People come to me and say, if I had a decent problem, if I had a decent program, I wouldn't be getting a divorce. And I say to them, I don't know about that. You don't drink while you're going through this divorce and people can watch you and you will be a model. And people come to me and they say, this kind of stuff is going down, and I have to file bankruptcy, and this economics thing is, and I don't know what to do. And I say, don't drink and go to meetings. And they come to me and they say, I have a relationship I don't understand. I don't know what to do about it. And I think that what they want me to do is to tell them how to seduce them again. And what I, and they say, what, you know, what am I really supposed to be doing here? And I say, well, I think what you're supposed to do is not drink and go to meetings and concentrate on working with others. Because if you're walking the way you're supposed to be, what happens is your program is the program of attraction rather than promotion too. Personally. And I think we are. And I think that's why we're the most beautiful people I know. I believe that. And what's happened to me in my life today is I got a whole bunch of people talking about experience, strength, and hope. I got a whole bunch of people coming up behind me, and they're asking me all sorts of questions. And they're hanging on to me, and I'm holding tight, you know, and I'm sharing my experience with them. And there's some people that came ahead of me, and they're giving me the information that I need so that I can be a channel to the guys on this side. And I'm holding on to them, and they're giving me the hope. And I'm standing here in a position of real strength. And I got to tell you something, guys. When you walk through life holding on with both hands to that kind of a chain, you cannot fall down. Thank you.